AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Hello and welcome to another Books of the Year podcast from your very good friends at Books of the Year, the podcast, much loved by everybody. And obviously, what with it being Christmas and everything, this will be our penultimate pod before we take a little break over the festive period. I think we've had a cracking year.
We have, yeah. We've had a good few cracking years, but some great titles come out this year, so there's plenty to look back on.
What would be your favourite?
I've been pretty vocal about The Art of a Lie by Laura Shepherd Robinson, who we had on. That has been, I've read a lot of books this year, and that is standing head and shoulders. I absolutely adored that book and have been telling just about everyone to pick it up. What about you?
If I'm absolutely honest, yeah. My favourite book was not on...
Not on our programme. Oh, my goodness.
Not on our programme. And that is because Tim Winton didn't come here. Okay. Tim Winton, one of Australia's greatest writers. And he wrote a book called The Juice. Was it? No, it was just Juice, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Single word title. It's not a particularly cheery and optimistic book.
Oh, right.
Because Tim is, apart from being a fantastic writer, he's an Australian. And in his part of Australia, it gets to 50 degrees twice a year, and he's an environmental campaigner. And
right.
So this is a kind of a post-apocalyptic world.
Okay.
Really, it's not Mad Max, it's sort of beyond Mad Max. It's
Like, wow. Oh, my goodness.
A few hundred years beyond that.
Okay.
So that was pretty astonishing. But anyway, we'll try and get him on at some stage. Other notable books, I think The Predicament, William Boyd.
Yeah. No, and that was really good, yes.
Elif Shafak was great.
Yeah. Nick Harkaway's book, Carla's Choice, that would be on my list of my top books this year, I think.
The Big Empty. Robert Crace.
Yeah. No, I'm a huge Robert Crace fan.
You say Black Tag, otherwise I'm
Yeah, Black Tag by Simon Mayo, obviously. So, yes.
Paperback next year, by the way.
Oh, really?
That's what I'm expecting.
Oh, well.
Email from Jeff Locke in Peacehaven in East Sussex. Simon and Adam, I'm sat writing Christmas cards, listening to your conversation with Ken Follett, and just wanted to write and say thank you for the brilliant pod and for your company over the last year. I live on my own, and whilst I see friends and family quite regularly, I do crave company sometimes. Your radio show and your books podcast have been a real blessing. Long may they continue. So I just wanted to wish you both and fellow listeners a very happy Christmas. I look forward to more book chat in the new year. So do we. Peaceful wishes from Jeff Locke in Peacehaven.
Well done. Very corporate of you there, Jeff. Well done. Many thanks. An email from Julianne. Dear Bookish Ones, on a recent pod, one of your listeners, it was Leo, mentioned they make a Christmas reading list every year. And I love the sound of this so much, I've decided to copy their idea. Four books might be a stretch for me, so I'm going to start with three. I already know that I want to read the latest Richard Osman, The Impossible Fortune, but I'm open to other suggestions. Old or new fiction, please. Thanks for the great podcast and Merry Christmas, says Julianne. Is the one book fiction that you would throw out that is not Black Tag? Obviously, that would need to be number one.
That's interesting because a Christmas reading list is not necessarily the same.
Yes.
As a reading list that you would, you know, if you're going on a nice long holiday or a beach read, that's very interesting. So on a Christmas list. Do you think it has to have some Christmas in it?
I know, but I think it needs... My personal feeling is that Christmas is the time for murder. It's the time for detectives uncovering a murder, that kind of thing. So that's,
is that what Christmas is all
Christmas,
about?
Christmas, I believe that is the central...
Jesus came and he said, it's a time for detective fiction.
It is.
And the wise men.
In the wise men with the lead piping in the conservatory. So, yes, I would go down the road of get yourself myself a really good bit of detective fiction. Obviously, I'm always a massive fan of Ian Rankin, so I'd always say a Rebus book will do you absolutely what you need.
Yeah, it's also traditionally kind of a ghost story time as well.
That's true. Yeah, yeah.
Well, let me chip in with, I mean, the only time I've actually read a book in one sitting, or although I was lying down with a fever.
Okay.
It was a Christmas day that I had to cry because I just had the flu or something. And I read this is the most obvious thing. I read A Christmas Carol for the first time, but I read it all the way through.
Okay, wow.
Which, of course, is like the perfect time.
Absolutely, of course it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a ghost story.
Yeah.
And in the world of audiobooks, because they are becoming increasingly important, as we mentioned, we're going to mention with Anne Cleves when we have the conversation that it's been a huge year for audiobooks. One of the great audiobooks is Heartburn by Nora Ephron.
Oh, right.
Read by Meryl Streep. And it's more of a performance, really, rather than a straight reading. But she's absolutely got it 100% perfect. It's a good, you know, it's a good book, but it's a fantastic audiobook. So, Julianne, does that help?
I mean, well, there's a few there, Julianne. Come on, that'll see you through to the new year, I'm going to guess.
Remember, if you'd like to get in touch with us, we'd always love to hear about what you're reading and enjoying. Perhaps tell us what books you got for Christmas, what worked and what absolutely didn't. The email is, as always, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We are on Instagram, Threads and Blue Sky at Pick Any Page. Are we on Threads as Pick Any Page? I have never seen any postings at all on Threads at Pick Any Page.
A little word certainly, our social team.
Yes,
there. Yeah.
That's right. But Instagram and Blue Sky, certainly. Anyway, right, let's now talk to our best-selling crime novelist guest, who is Anne Cleves. Yes, I'm delighted to say that Anne Cleves is in the studio to talk about The Killing Stones, her latest, I was going to say thriller, crime novel. Hello, Anne, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Well, it's fantastic to have you, and I feel kind of guilty that we haven't had you on sooner, but anyway, we're putting that right at the end of the year. Matt, describe the cover, please.
So we've got a figure. We're looking from the back of this figure, and that figure is looking out onto a storm-tossed horizon. So we've got clouds on the horizon, and they're stood on the beach with their feet sinking into the sand, and there's a flock of seagulls around them as well. And then Anne Cleves in big, bold, orange letters, The Killing Stones, the number one Sunday Times bestseller. David Baldacci says, great storytelling. Louise Penny says, one of my favourite writers, and at the bottom, the return of Jimmy Perez.
Okay, well, let's start there. Just in many people listening will know all about Jimmy Perez, but some people won't. So it says that right on the cover. So let's address those two. What are The Killing Stones, and why has Jimmy Perez returned?
Jimmy Perez appeared in 8 books set in Shetland. And I love writing them. I know Shetland very well. I lived there for a while, dropped out of university and ended up working as an assistant cook in the Bird Observatory on Fair Isle, which is one of the Shetland Islands, and Jimmy Perez's home. So I started writing about him. After 8 books, I thought I'd said enough about Shetland. And he was quite a dour and boring kind of guy. I think I'd had enough of him.
Isn't that your fault?
Yeah, well, maybe. But he'd found love in his life, and I just sent them both off into the sunset. But I sent them to Orkney and thought, that was it. He's away. He's got Willow, his new partner, who is also his boss. But then I live in northeast England, but got really homesick for the north and for the islands and started just getting that tug to go back and write about them again and explore them again. And also a bit of curiosity about how Jimmy was getting on, that maybe he would be a little bit less miserable and he would have a family now and he would have matured and he might have developed a sense of humour at last. And so it would be quite fun to go and explore him. I know Orkney quite well. I first went there 50 years ago when I first went to Shetland for a brief visit, but not as well as Shetland. So I went back and stayed with a friend, and it was just before Christmas and it was freezing. And he was an islander. His parents still farm in Westray, one of the islands. And I came back really with a story.
And that's very interesting that you mentioned that you went just before Christmas, because that's where the book is set. Because I just want to say right at the very beginning of this conversation, you need to get this book now.
Mm.
Don't wait until Christmas. By all means, gift it. That's a very good thing. But give it as like an Advent present. Give it as like an early Christmas present, because this book is set up to Christmas and Christmas Day. And I think it would make a fantastic read through December.
And I hope so. And if you like cold and frosty settings and islands and a bit of bleak wildness, you might enjoy it too.
Yeah. Okay. And what would you like to say about the title? And what would, and then you can just leave it as vague as possible.
I think Orkney is famous for its Neolithic structure. So it's got standing stones, and it's got Mize Howe, which is a burial chamber. And I knew all that. But until I went and did the research, I hadn't realised that when the Vikings came, their young people were very different from our young people. So they're really into graffiti. So all these ancient Neolithic structures are covered with bits of Viking graffiti. And some of it's really quite smutty. But I thought it might be quite fun to, because it's about history, this book, and it's about bones that are buried and secrets that are buried, I suppose, that I would have the killing stones. I call them the Westray killing stones, which are completely fictitious. But they're two round stones that were once featured in a feasting chamber, a Neolithic feasting chamber. But then the Vikings came and they scrawled all over them. And on one of the stones it says, "I am Olaf, teller of tales." And the other one says, "Hear my stories and know death."
So these are the story stones. You've made up those story stones. They don't exist, then?
No, they don't exist. I made those up.
Wow, they're great. Yeah, no, they're integral. I want to talk to you about Shetland, because this is the first of your books set there that I've read. And you have one character saying, "You're an incomer yourself. Fur Isle might be close enough as the crow flies, and there are connections I know, but Shetlanders and Orcadians are a different kind of breed."
Yeah.
And I just wanted you to talk a little bit more about this, about how people living on islands so close to each other that we would absolutely lump together are a different kind of breed.
Yeah, they are quite a long way away. If you look at a map, Shetland is right far. Orkney is just off the top of Scotland, and Shetland is a long way north. But the trope that everybody says is that Shetlanders are fishermen with a croft. So they're water people, they're sailors. They were off whaling. That's... If you go to Shetland, every graveyard is by the sea, because that was the only way you could get the body to be buried, is to go by boat. And Orkney is where this book is set, is much gentler, it's greener, it's fertile. And they will say that Orcadians are farmers with a boat. So that, I think, and Orcadians think they're slightly more civilized and more cultured. Shetlanders will probably disagree, but their culture is probably more Scandinavian. So lots of the place names have Scandinavian roots, and they belonged to Norway, Denmark, until I think the 15th century, when they were gifted back to Scotland as part of a dowry.
And I think just in just further on from that section that Matt's mentioned, when you're describing the difference, you say, or is it one of your characters says, that if you were going to gender the islands, that Shetland is more macho, and so that Orkney would be feminine?
Yeah, it's just gentler, it's rounder, and it's, I guess in a way, it's prettier. So if you're in Orkney and you look out, you see there are lots of big lochs, and then you see more land, and then there's sea, and the islands are closer together. So you have this wonderful vista of water and land and more water. It's very, very bonny.
When you're constructing a tale like this, Anne, and it's interesting that you said that you went to Orkney and you came back with the story, would your normal method be to work backwards, to work out who is going to cop it and who is going to have done the copying? Or do you start with a body and see what happens?
Very much start with a body and see what happens. For my first, 2026 will be my 40th year of being published. For the first 20 years, I had no commercial success. I was mainstream published. The books went into the libraries, but my advances were so small that I just about crept over the accountant's line that they kept publishing me. And I always had to have a day job. So it had to be fun. And if I knew how it was going to end, I just wouldn't be no fun in doing that. So sometimes I don't even know who the victim is. I just start. So with this book, I wanted to establish, I suppose, that Jimmy Perez was different and he had a home life and he had security and comfort. So it starts with Willow, his partner, and their small child, and she's pregnant again, coming home on the ferry. And she knows that Jimmy will be there waiting for her and the fire will be banked, and you get this sort of sense of security, I hope. And so she goes into the house, but he's not there. And that brings in the first sense of unease that things aren't going to be straightforward in the run-up to Christmas.
So let's talk about Jimmy and Willow then, who are, as you say, they're partners, but they're also the detectives and they're investigating this crime. So reading your book, I was struck that I can't remember the last time I had two detectives investigating a murder, but they are on separate islands. They're on completely different locations. And there is a very good reason for that, which is explained in the book, why they need to be in different locations. But it also struck me that, and you took a deliberate decision to put them in different places, so they're not together. So they're investigating these murders independently, as it were. What was your thinking behind that? Because, as I say, it makes perfect sense in the book as far as the logistics are concerned, but it also felt like a deliberate device by you.
I suppose I wanted them each to tell their own story, so we see the action through different perspectives. I like doing that. You know, you show the same thing from two different angles. And also, I suppose it's a little bit of, I've got friends who work in Scotland, and there was quite a lot of resentment when Police Scotland was developed and everything was taken down to the Central Belt to Glasgow. And they lost that sense of familiarity with a place. And so I have very bad weather, which means that normally the serious crime squad or the murder squad team or whatever they would be called will be up doing that investigation. Yeah. And they're not, because it's just before Christmas and the weather's bad. And if they do go, they might not get home. And so they just let Willow and Jimmy get on with it.
It's worth plugging the audiobook, because it's absolutely extraordinary. Kenny Blythe is the actor who reads. And for a southerner like me, to have someone who can clearly hear the difference between Shetland and hear the difference between Shetland and Orkney, and then the difference maybe between the different islands of Orkney, you know, how would you even begin to describe the difference between Westry and Orkney as far as an accent point of view? Well, listen to this guy, because he's got it. Can you?
Yeah, he's mesmerising. He's amazing. His sister lives in Orkney, so he does have connections there, I think. But he's just a great actor.
There is one moment, I think, where you describe a sound that's different when pronounced by an Orcadian. Can you, just for people who don't have access to the audiobook just at the moment, how would you begin to describe in words the difference in the accents that we're encountering in the book?
Orkney is more lilting. It's almost Welsh. The sort of rhythm of it is almost Welsh. And instead of just, they would say chust. It's a very different kind of accent. Shetland is very, very different. Again, it is much more Scandinavian. It's got I can't. And if you get Shetlanders talking in dialect and talking amongst themselves, especially the island of Walser, it's famous that even mainland Shetlanders struggle to understand them. But they have something called knapping, which is when you speak slowly for English people to be able to understand you.
Yes, well, I'm glad that they do.
Yes, thanks very much. So I finished this literally on the tube on the way to this interview, Anne, and I loved it. And I read a lot of detective crime novels, And I am amazed and so disappointed at myself that I never seem to work it out at all. And I didn't work it out with yours. I think it was literally about two lines before the murderer is arrested that I work it out. Literally two lines. But before that, I was completely in the dark and I was following all the lovely false trails that you lay down for us. And it got me to thinking, and when you're reading those crime novels written by other people, are you surprised as much as I? Because I find myself thinking, I read so much of these, you'd think by now I'd be able to work these things out, but I don't. How are you when you're reading crime novels? Do you allow yourself to be taken along, or do you find yourself going, ah, I've spotted that breadcrumb?
No, I allow myself just to be carried on. I don't want to know. I love that cheap thrill of the surprise ending. And if I can, you can't always do it, but if I can do it for other readers, that's great. And if I can't, then maybe I'm doing something else within the book that's equally, that's perhaps more important. But no, I don't want to know until the end. I'm delighted. I'm quite disappointed if I can work out who's done it.
Do you though spot those breadcrumbs that perhaps the rest of us are missing?
Sometimes I think, just because you know how you would do it, so you understand how other people do it.
How many false trails do you think you need? So as we go through the story, we meet a whole bunch of people. An awful lot of them could have done it. And we have our suspicions. But you would never just do that with like one or two people. How many do you think it would be nice going into the denouement that we're still not sure about?
I don't know that I count them up. But it's because I don't know. That's how I can do it. Because I don't know who's done it until about two-thirds of the way through either. So I need each of the witnesses to be possible suspects.
Okay.
And then I start to think, oh, well, you know, maybe Jimmy and I work it out, start to to get there at about the same time.
Because there is a wonderful sense of frustration sort of halfway, two-thirds through the book, and maybe this comes from the fact that you still don't know who's done it, because Jimmy and all this, they're not getting anywhere. They're talking to a lot of people. It's a small space comparatively. And there is that, we feel as though maybe we're getting somewhere, but he is just fantastically frustrated, which is great fun to write, I would have thought.
It was great fun to write because he's questioning himself and his own judgment and his own competence, I suppose. And at one point he's thinking, I can't do this anymore. I'm just no good at it. I'm just hopeless. I might have to give it up, or it's too painful, or I'm too close to it because the victim is a very close friend of his. And as he's digging into his past, he's finding out that he's not the man that he thought he was. And that disappointment that comes from realising that a hero and a friend has flaws as well is something that we've maybe all had to live with.
So like I said, I finished this on the way here, and as I finished the book and then I closed it and looked at the back, and there's a quote from Mick Herron, which I think is a really good one, where it says, Anne Cleves is one of our secret chroniclers, charting under cover of a series of expertly plotted and mesmerising crime novels how we live now. And we're obviously not going to talk about the ending, but certainly the ending speaks to how we live now. Is that a conscious decision of yours that you decide with your books that I do want, I'm you know, this is a crime novel, there's going to be a murder, we're going to find the murderer, but I also there's something else that I'd like to talk to.
Yeah, I think I live in the world that we live in now, and I don't want just to write fairy stories. So I think if you write even traditional crime fiction as I do, if we look at what police have to deal with now, they're not just going out and solving murders. They are our first responders because we're so stretched with social services. The NHS is so stretched. So if there's a kid that's run away from a care home, or an old guy who's wandering around because he's got dementia and nobody knows where he is, or somebody's having a psychotic episode in a shopping mall, it'll be the police who'll go out to deal with it. So we can deal with all those things and matters of not just of criminal justice, but also social justice. I think it's something that is there for us all to write about. And that was very kind of Mick. He's a great writer, and he's somebody that I admire very much.
So one of the many things that's great about this book, Anne, is that it's very much set in 2025. You know, that is where it is. But it's a classic story. You know, there's a version of this story which could have been 100 years old. And you've managed to pull those together. And there is an event which is talked about, and we witness it, the Orkney Bar.
Yes.
Spelt B-A, which happens on Christmas Day and New Year's Day, I think. I was so fascinated. I was just watching a lot of stuff about it this morning and the kind of bun fight and craziness that's involved. Obviously, if you've been on Orkney on Christmas Day, you'll know all about this. Can you just begin to describe? It was just a wonderful place to for you to be describing for us, but just introduce us to what the Orkney Bar is.
Well, bar is short for ball, and the ball is a very heavy kind of medicine ball, leather ball. And it starts off just outside St. Magnus Cathedral, and somebody has the honour of throwing the bar out. And there are two teams, the Uppies and the Doonies. And in the past, I think the Doonies all grew up or were born or had to be born in one bit of Kirkwall, and then the Uppies the other bit. But then quite a lot of the off-islanders, so the smaller islands, they were born in the hospital in Kirkwall, so that, you know, they had to be a bit flexible about that. And it's like a sort of crazy, unregulated rugby match. And you have to either get the ball right down into the harbour, or there's a point up the town where you get the bar to. And it's like a scrum, and it's all the men that want to join in, and it's bonkers.
How many men are we talking about?
As many as want to be there. I mean, it's a huge team. I'm not sure there are very many rules. I tried to get some rules when I was writing about it, and I'm not sure that there are any.
And there aren't team colours or anything. Everyone's just turning up, you know.
They know
Matt could take part like that. You just turn up in a rugby shirt and jeans.
That's right. And they all know who they are, I guess. But the shopkeepers all board up their windows because they're worried that the windows are going to be smashed in by this craziness.
How do you win?
You win either by getting the ball right up into the top of the town, or they jump into the harbour, the ones who are going that way.
On Christmas Day.
On Christmas Day.
And New Year's Day.
Yeah.
Is there a women's bar?
I did ask. Apparently they tried it once, but it got too rough. So they decided they'd stop it.
Really?
Apparently.
Because the 5-minute film that I was watching, that looked pretty rough. It looked like a medieval fight between two villages.
You know? I think that the women are just at home having cooked Christmas dinner, just thinking, what am I doing here? Just get home. Just don't be so stupid. But no, I think everybody enjoys it, and it's a big deal. If it's mostly Kirkwall folk, it's not usually people from other islands.
Yeah, because you gendered Shetland and Orkney, it doesn't feel very feminine.
No, that is quite macho. Yeah.
Does Shetland have an equivalent? Because that would be
Shetland has Upheliar, which is third Tuesday, which is the fire festival where they drag a big galley through the streets and then set fire to it.
I was very interested when you started talking about Jimmy Perez and how many books you'd written with him, and that you were beginning to find him boring, almost as though you didn't like his company.
Yeah.
Really. What is that? Is that just you wanting to try something new, or does every character have a lifespan, really?
I think most characters do have a life. I know people like poor Ian Rankin is still having to write about Rebus. I can remember doing an event with him when Wildfire, the last of the Shetland books, was coming out, and I said, no, I'm stopping after Wildfire. And he looked at me, well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, sometimes readers are just so attracted to a character that it's very, very... And I'm good friends with Louise Penny, and her Inspector Gamache comes back in Quebec time after time, and she's certainly not bored with him. She's still writing about him. But I like to alternate. I like to alternate geographically as well. So I like that sense of moving from the Northern Isles down to Northumberland and then down to North Devon for the Matthew Venn books.
So Have you given Jimmy Perez more life by, first of all, moving him to Orkney, but now he's with Willow, who you said is his boss?
Yeah.
So they do talk about this together. I mean, they're at work and they're at home. Is this the beginning of something new?
Yeah, I think so. I loved writing that book, and I'll certainly do more, I think. Yeah, and it gives me an excuse to go north again regularly.
So is that sort of more Willow, less Jimmy?
I'm not sure. Maybe it allows me the flexibility to do both, I think. Because of the whole centralisation of Police Scotland, I've made her in charge of all the islands, which means if I want to do an Isla whiskey book, I can do that. Or if I want to do a North Uist Western Isles book, I can do that.
What would your readers want, do you think? The ones that they see you at the readings and they say, could you do...
They like Jimmy Perez, so I think he'd have to feature somewhere in any book that I wrote.
They like Jimmy Perez more than you do, by the sound of it.
No, I'm developing a new relationship with him. That's fine.
Did you think of killing him off?
No. No, that's hard, because then you can never go back to them, and sometimes you know that you might want to.
You have a number of returning characters. You mentioned Vera, you mentioned Jimmy's Matthew as well. Is it just something that you sense as you go through the year that it's time to revisit? Oh, I'm intrigued. Let's go and find out what's up there.
Yeah, it is that. And it's also, well, you know, it's contracts as well. They like to know what you're doing ahead of time. So I do have a lot of flexibility. But yeah, it is that. And so I will probably write about those three places for a while. Northumberland and North Devon and the Northern Isles, but yeah.
And are you getting faster? Or are you slowing down? I mean, in terms of getting through the book and getting through a story.
I still do a book a year, and that's fine. That leaves me time to do other stuff, and leaves me time to... We tour mostly around publication, and that's great fun, but I've got lovely readers in Canada and Australia, and it's quite nice to have the space and the time to go and visit there too.
Well, we hope you carry on writing. We hope that as you go around the next few weeks and months, you come up with other stories. How many stories do you have in your head at any one time?
I'm really focused on the one that I'm writing at the moment. I might maybe know where I'm going next. It's what I'm writing at the moment that is in my head. And I don't write notes at all, because I need it there. And I think when you know a character really well, you're writing from memory rather than imagination. It's as if you know them and you're writing about somebody that you know, which is why recurring characters in a way are a lot easier, because you don't have that great need for that energy to set them up each time.
Okay. And it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for talking to us. There'll be another conversation with Anne, which will come in a few days' time when we do our Q&A. But Anne Cleeve's book is The Killing Stones. As you mentioned, you have to buy it now, or read it now. Yeah. Download it now. Listen to the audiobook now, because it's the perfect companion going up to Christmas. I mean, Charles Dickens was fine. But this is the book that you need.
Well, thanks very much to both of you. It's been lovely chatting.
And thank you. And the Q&A will be with you very shortly.